Well, I didn't want to follow Jim Keener. When I saw him ahead of me, I thought, oh, I'm lost now because he gives such great presentations. He gave lots of pictures and lots of movies. I just show pictures, that's it, and words. Actually, I'm glad he spoke before me because he actually explained a lot of things that I was going to explain or need to explain in my talk, so I can skip those things. First of all, these are recent colleagues that have been working on this problem with me. Washong Wong, who is here, he's sitting right back there. Ben Steinberg, who's actually a graduate student at in physiology at McGill University, or undergraduate. And Yuching Wang, a former postdoc of mine, who now is working in my math finance here and at the Royal Bank. So what I want to tell you about is four things. They're not necessarily equally spaced here. There's a phenomenon called spreading cortical depression, which you heard about yesterday morning. And what I'm going to tell you today are two basic ideas. One is that we don't know what is happening with spreading cortical depression. We thought we did, but we don't know now. Second is I want to tell you a little bit about a technique called the Lattice-Boltzmann equation method, which is a way of solving these kind of problems and which actually may have applicability to a number of other problems that you've heard about over the last 2 days. So what I'll do in my talk today is describe what spreading cortical depression is, sort of duplicating a little bit what Fran Wilkinson said yesterday, tell you a little bit about the brain cell microenvironment that we're thinking about, and give you some examples of diffusion of ions in the extracellular space and in the intracellular space, and then tell you a little bit about this concept of spatial buffering. Some of these ideas actually are very similar to what Jim talked about, although in a completely different context. So what is the motivation? The first motivation for myself was there's a researcher named Henry Tuckwell, some of you who may know him. He was a postdoc at UBC when I was there, and he showed me a bunch of papers on the brain, one of which had target patterns. And to me, target patterns means reaction diffusion equations. So at that time, I was thinking more like a mathematician, and so I thought, well, that must be easy to model. So that was our objective, and it was only after this sort of curiosity type research that got started that we found out that, in fact, there was possibly some connection with classic migraine, which Fran Wilkinson talked about yesterday. There's also some possibilities of connection with seizures, and in fact, it was first seen in experiments on epileptic seizures. My interest has been trying to figure out how to utilize the structure of the brain. What we did earlier, and I'll talk about that today, what we did earlier was to just treat the brain as a continuum, and you'll see how we did that. But more recently, it's become clearer to me, at least, that I think we need to look at it at a more cellular level. We need to take into account some of the structure of the brain itself. So involved in that are the concept of tortuosity and volume fraction, which I'm not going to say anything about, and possible applications to a technique called diffusion tensor imaging, which is a way of imaging the brain, for example, and trying to determine the structures there by computing the diffusion tensor. I'm not going to say anything about that, but just tell you that's a possible application. More importantly, today I'm going to focus on ion concentrations in the microenvironment of neurons and including glial cells, and the idea is to try to maintain balance of ions around these cells during neural activity. What I'm really going to talk about today is really going back to ground zero, because all the ideas that we had before in trying to explain spreading depression presumably are in question. So maybe we better go back and try to understand some of the fundamentals. And then again, spatial buffering, I'll explain what that is. So first of all, let me tell you what spreading depression is, and again, I'm going to repeat a little bit of what Fran said yesterday. This occurs in a variety of animals. Here's rabbit, cat, rat, others, and possibly human. We're still not completely sure about that. stimuli. You can apply chemicals, you can apply electrical stimuli, mechanical stimuli, physiological stimuli, and it occurs in a variety of different structures. One of which is very interesting is a retina, because you can actually see it. You can actually see this going around. So here is a picture of a caricature of a half a rat brain, looking at it from the top. That doesn't mean this is a half brain theory. It just means that this is a way of visualizing what's going on. So the idea is to put some sort of stimulus here, and what one observes at some distant electrode is waves of this phenomenon going by. And I'll tell you now what that phenomenon is. From the point of view of function, physiologists who do experiments on the brain treat this as a nuisance because they want to study things like epilepsy and so forth. They accidentally touch the brain or do something to the brain, and this wave starts out, and it just goes so slowly they have to wait forever for this thing to go away so they can continue their experiments. Psychologists use this for learning experiments because when spreading depression goes by, spreading depression is as if the tissue is all dead. And so as this wave goes by, they try to teach an animal something, and then if the animal doesn't learn it when the wave is at a certain location, they think maybe that's where the source of the learning is. Physicians have this connection with migraine, with aura, which Fran talked about yesterday. But now there's some question as to whether spreading depression is actually related to this. And that's up in the air. And that's one of the new things that have come out recently. So here's the phenomenon. It was originally discovered by a Brazilian physiologist doing his PhD work at Harvard in 1944. He was doing epilepsy in the rabbit. And he noticed after these epileptic waves, a wave propagating outward. This is a depression of the EEG. It has nothing to do with psychological depression, okay? This has to do with depression of the EEG, electroencephalogram. And the length of time of this depression is on the order of 2 minutes. This time, so here's the EEG activity, then it goes silent. There's a long period of silence, and then it recovers. So this is a very unusual phenomenon because that means that for some period of time, a certain region of the brain acts like it's dead. Nothing happens in that region. In many ways, this is very similar to action potentials, which some of you may be familiar with. There are lots of analogies. One of the things that we want to know about spreading cortical depression is how does it get started? If this is, in fact, related to aura and migraine headaches, how does it actually get started? We don't know that. We have not tried to model that. Our idea is to try to model the propagation. How does this thing actually propagate from one place to another? It has properties very similar to action potentials, which Jim just talked about. There are solitary waves. These are waves that travel along as a single waveform. They're all or none, so you either get it or you don't get it. It has refractoriness, as Jim pointed out, which I don't have to explain now. Multiple waves, you can have one wave after another, and you can get annihilation upon collision, which Jim also showed you. You take two waves, you run them into each other, and they wipe each other out. So here is a trace of extracellular ion concentration, and this is the main feature of spreading cortical depression. First of all, there's a basic difference in time and space scales. The phenomenon is slow. Speeds are on the order of 1 to 15 millimeters per minute. Yesterday, Hugh Wilson and Fran Wilkinson talked about speeds about 2.5 millimeters per minute. There seems to be a wide range of these things, and one of the things that you want to get from a model is to be able to reproduce this range of speeds. However, you also have long wavelengths relative to cell size. So that's the reason that I'm going to talk a little bit about continuous modeling, because we're talking about a phenomenon which is long compared to cell size. So you can think of the cells in some sense being mushed up together, like a continuum. The one thing that's important here is that spreading cortical depression has very large changes in ionic concentrations. And here's a picture of that. This is a millimoles per liter. And normal extracellular potassium, which is what this is on the order of 3 to 5 millimolar. But you see here there's an excursion that goes up to about 32. They go up to 40 and possibly even higher. normal extracellular potassium rarely goes above about 11 or 12 millimolar. So it's really pathological to go above this high. And you see the scale here. This is on the order of minutes, not milliseconds as an action potential. And so you get a high increase in extracellular potassium and then a recovery. And the same here, this extracellular calcium is believed, at least we believed at the time we did the modeling, that extracellular calcium was an extremely important ion. And here you see it going from about 0.8, 0.7 millimolar, and then dropping to extremely low levels in the extracellular space, and then recovering. Now, again, these things are very long phenomena. It's believed that there are no changes in the brain after this happens. Okay, there's some belief in that. There's also some belief that there are long-term changes in the brain after this happens. So these are all things that are unknown, and I think my message here today is to try to get people involved in this problem, because I think it's a huge problem, and it's got many different facets in it that are unexplored. So again, another part that Jim talked about, when the phenomenon was found in 1944, there were very few people who worked on it for many years, and then in the 50s, there was a whole batch of people who worked on this. And in particular, there's a person named Buresh in, was it Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, one of those countries, who has a lab, and he said that one might be able to model this by using the ideas of Wiener and Rosenbluth for cardiac. They have ideas for cardiac tissue. And so this is work that he thought about with Shibata, and then there was actually computer simulations that they did with Rashadko. And these ideas are basically cellular automata ideas, that you want to look at the propagation of an excitation as just cellular automata. Grafstein, Bernice Grafstein, who I think was either here in Toronto or in Montreal, I think she might have been here, said that in fact it looked like potassium was the most important ion in this phenomenon. You had to have large extracellular potassium. And that action potentials were important. The effect of action potential is that potassium would be released into the extracellular space, and that this would then propagate along and cause more action potentials. So Henry Tuckwell and I came onto this problem in the mid-1970s and came up with a theory based on what we said at that time was a neurotransmitter mechanism for this. The reason for choosing this particular model was that there was an experiment done by a Japanese physiologist named Sugaya and his colleagues who showed the following. You can take a piece of tissue and you can propagate spreading depression along this tissue. The question was, are action potentials essential for this phenomenon? And what they did was they took tetrodotoxin, which is a poison from the pufferfish, and they put it across a certain part of this tissue. TTX, tetrodotoxin, prevents action potentials from occurring. You don't get this spiking. So what they found is they could then stimulate spreading depression from one end and would propagate right through this region and go to the other side. So this meant that action potentials were not essential for this phenomenon. So our idea was, forget about the action potentials. What mechanism can cause this to propagate without action potentials? And our idea was that there must be release of neurotransmitter. Neurotransmitter usually is what's responsible for depolarizing cells, but you can get large amounts of neurotransmitter release by simple depolarization, which is also what Jim talked about. If you put a large amount of potassium outside a cell, it will automatically depolarize. And you can then get automatic release of neurotransmitter. This would then, neurotransmitter would then go and alter channels on the postsynaptic cells, and then you'd get more potassium dumped out, and this could then propagate on. So that was our idea, and we thought that was a great idea, and it worked. I'll show you some pictures. We got some nice model, solutions, and we thought, okay, we'll just forget about it. At least, well, Henry did more work, but I didn't do very much more work. And we'll just wait to see if the experimentalists will verify all of our results. Well, that never happened. And so just recently, in the last 10 years or so, actually about 11 or 12 years ago, I came to a meeting here, and Anna Lanacek, who is from Guelph, and Gary Doolin, who is from Los Alamos, gave a talk on the lattice gas algorithm. Some of you may know this is a numerical technique for solving fluid flow problems or chemical reaction problems, and in porous media, for example. And I thought, that's a great idea for trying to study this particular phenomenon, because the way we had studied this before was as a continuum. But I want to know what happens in the real brain. What happens when you have structure there? The lattice gas algorithm is a great technique for doing that. So that's what we're going to try to do, is try to actually apply these techniques to study ion diffusion and some of these other things in brain tissue. There are a lot of problems, and I'm going to try to point out what some of those problems are. Now, a couple years ago, actually, I only found out about it last fall, there's a guy named Bruce Shapiro, who was a graduate student at UCLA, had published a paper on another model for spreading cortical depression. Completely different from ours. Completely different. He requires osmosis. He requires the movement of water across the membranes. He requires cells to get larger or smaller. He also needs connections, electrical connections between neurons. You have neuronal gap junctions. So here's a new theory, and it predicts all these phenomena, the same spreading depression. So we're at a complete loss now. We don't know what's right. We don't think we're completely right. We're not sure he's completely right. We're not sure what the mechanisms are, because there's this question now as to whether spreading depression is even related to migraine. So there's lots of open questions. So what I'm going to tell you about today are some of the things that we're thinking about and might be of interest to you. Okay, here's this is old and outdated, of course. These are the equations that Henry Tuckwell and I put down as a model for this phenomenon. And the idea here is a very simple one. Take the brain and treat it as a continuum. Well, the first thing you're going to say is, well, there's intracellular space and there's extracellular space. The way to think about this is that there's something in plasma physics called the two-bag theory. You treat electrons one way and protons a different way, and you superpose them. It's the same idea here. Except here, to find out what the extracellular space ion concentration is, you move to some location where it's the extracellular space and measure it there. Or if you want to know what the intracellular is, you measure some other location where it's intracellular. But once you've done that, you smooth it all over and just superpose them. So here, the equations are simply nonlinear diffusion equations. And this is extracellular potassium, extracellular calcium. We felt that only two ions were necessary, because potassium and calcium seem to be the most important ions. Potassium, because it's the main ion that's diffusing and depolarizing the cells, and calcium, because that's what was responsible for neurotransmitter release. Okay, so those are the two. So I'm not going to go into details here. These are just, this is the diffusion coefficient terms, and then these are the ion currents going through the membrane. These are the ionic currents, active channel currents, and this is the pumps. These are the things that require energy to move things back and forth across the membrane. And you can see this is an old paper. This is 78. It's a long time ago. If you solve those equations, these are the kind of solutions you get. And you can see that, you know, you get some resemblance to the kind of potassium levels. These are up around 15 to 20 millimolar. And you get about the speed of 1 millimeter per minute, which is about what's observed, at least one end of the spectrum that's observed. The question we had was, these things have variable speeds. We can't vary the speeds of these things with our model, because in our models, the speed is mainly determined by the diffusion coefficient. And the diffusion coefficient is fixed. It's not something you can vary. So the question is, why why is this wave going at different speeds? This is down here is just a theoretical paper showing the existence of these kind of waves from a singular perturbation point of view. Okay, so why study SD again? Why did I come back to this after I dropped it for a number of years? One is this, I found that this lattice gas algorithm looks like something that might be usable. You treat the brain as a porous medium, except it's not a real porous medium because now ions can also go in and out of these rocks, right? There's nerve cells. They can actually go in and out of those. The other nice thing about this algorithm is that it's stable. It's a stable algorithm. And unfortunately, it's computationally intensive. It requires lots of computational power to do that. Now, I'm not so worried about that because every year the power, computing power increases. And in fact, at IBM, I know there's a Project Blue Gene. They're expecting to put a 15 teraflop machine, develop one very soon, and even have a 1 teraflop machine you can get on your desk. So that's going to be a pretty powerful machine. I'm interested in brain structure effects. We want to look at a model that is not a continuous model, not necessarily a continuum model as we had done before. And of course, Shapiro's computational model blew our model out of the water in a sense. And then there's this question about, is SD really related to classic migraine? That's a separate question. It's a functional question. But at the same time, it's something that you would like to keep in the back of your mind. Are there any real practical applications of understanding this particular phenomenon? Okay, so let's talk about dispersal of ions in the brain cell microenvironment, talking a little bit about the geometric structure. I'm going to forget about spiking at this point. We're not going to worry about that. We'd like to come back to do that. We're not going to do SD. We're not going to do spreading depression, even though I've told you about it. I just want to give you the context in which we're trying to do these studies. SD requires a lot of other things to be put into the model that at this time we don't quite know how to do. Ionic concentrations change very slowly. So one of the things that we had in the other model was we did not have a membrane potential equation. It was specified by what's called the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz formula, just determined by the ionic concentrations. We'll see when we talk about spatial buffering that that's no longer the case. In the extracellular space and intracellular space, we're going to assume the ions undergo pure diffusion. That's a very simple model for ion diffusion. And then we're going to assume that at some point we've injected potassium. We're not worried about the instigation problem, but we're worried that at least you have to start the wave off someplace or start the ionic changes someplace. So this is an electron micrograph of a small region of rat cortex, and you can see it's pretty complicated, but we're going to use this as a starting point to try to build a little simple model for a two-dimensional structure. Everything is going to be done computationally. It's just too hard otherwise. And this is taken from a paper by Charles Nicholson and Sikova. And Charles Nicholson is actually one of the pioneers in this whole area of understanding spreading depression and ion movements in the extracellular space. So the difficulties here are the complicated three-dimensional geometric structures. One of the real problems, and one that I don't know how it's going to be resolved, is how do you get pictures of three-dimensional structures? That was a two-dimensional structure. There are tons of pictures of two dimensions. Most of them are not usable because they are in fixed tissue, and when you fix tissue, the size of extracellular space changes. The picture I just showed you is one of the few that has correct extracellular dimensions. There are many different kinds of processes, neurons, glial cells, axons, synapses. There are many different kinds of ions with different diffusion coefficients. What I showed you earlier was a continuous equation for two different diffusion coefficients, potassium and calcium. There are connections between neurons, there are synapses, and between glial cells, there are gap junctions, and in Shapiro's theory, there are connections between neurons. So that's a another thing that one is going to have to worry about. Cell membranes have distributions of ion channel densities. They are not uniform. The density of ion channels in the soma, the cell bodies, are different than in the dendrites, and even in the dendrite there could be a distribution. So those are things that one is going to have to worry about eventually. So here's a cleaned up picture of that electron micrograph. I just took this and put it in Photoshop and cleaned it up. I just erased all the stuff I didn't want. And so now it gives me the dark stuff here is the extracellular space, and the light region is the intracellular space, and we're assuming there's nothing inside and nothing outside other than this free space. So that's where we get this. This is another way you could generate cellular cells, and that is to take a region and put in seeds, and then let the seeds grow, and then have criteria for how large the extracellular space can be. So that's just an algorithm for doing that. And here we have tortuosity is about 1.5. So we're assuming that what happens is that whenever you go down one of these paths, it's going to take you about 1.5 times to go from here to here if you go along this crooked path. That this particular case is not a good example of that. But, and the volume fraction, these thicknesses are chosen so that the volume fraction for the extracellular space is about 20%. That's a standard value for extracellular space. So free diffusion is a standard diffusion equation. That's these two equations for potassium, sodium, chloride. You could actually put calcium in there as well. It's just pure diffusion in the extracellular space and in the intracellular space. And now we're going to solve these using the lattice-Boltzmann equation. The lattice-Boltzmann equation, the lattice-Boltzmann or the lattice cellular automata method is a very simple idea. All you do is you put particles on nodes, and then you just move the particles according to some algorithm. And the hard part is figuring out what the algorithm should be. So here's what we do. We set up a rectangular grid, and the white inside of here means intracellular space, and the dark means extracellular space. Now this is just a mock-up so that I can show you what the things are that we include in here. The ions move according to three things. You put ions in by injection. You move the ions, so that's propagation. And then when ions come together at a given node, you have collisions. So those are the three steps in propagating this algorithm. It's very simple. One of the beauties of this whole idea, I think. And I don't want to get into details of these equations, but this is basically the way you calculate the concentration at a particular node. You just sum up these NJ. J simply means ions that have reached this particular spot coming in from a different direction, four different directions in this two-dimensional case. If you want to do this, you could also do it in three dimensions, but then it gets more difficult. Zero simply means that there's ions that stay at a given location. The important thing here is that one wants to treat problems with different diffusion coefficients. So the way you do that is there's a probability of an ion that is sitting here, probability of it going off in a given direction, and you want to take that into account. You want to do this in a deterministic way. So we assume that all of these, because this is simple diffusion, all of these probabilities are in fact equal, and just 1 minus the probability of staying at a particular position divided by 4. That's the probability of going off in these different directions. For the fastest diffusion, the largest diffusion coefficient, we just set this P0 equal to 0. So for the fastest diffusion coefficient, you then are propagating everything outwards. Okay, and that will give you the right diffusion for that particular ion. If you have a slower diffusing ion, then you want to make these quantities here different so that you get the right diffusion coefficient. Lambda here is simply the space spacing between these nodes, and tau, I don't know if I have tau here, is the time step between given iterations of this scheme. Again, I'm not going to go into details. I just want to indicate that there are boundary conditions you have to worry about. These little diamonds correspond to the boundary between the intracellular space and the extracellular space. These are not nodes. So you have to worry about how ions cross this membrane. What I showed you in the previous slide is just what happens in free space, where there's just pure diffusion. Now you have to worry about how ions cross the membrane, and there you have to worry about ion flows through channels and through pumps. This is just to indicate some of the complexity in just doing the programming, because you have many different possibilities for these boundaries and the relationship between the extracellular nodes and the intracellular nodes. That's just, and then the boundary condition on the outside of the whole region was simply chosen so that they maintain the extracellular concentration. That means that what you do is you choose the outside so that no cell actually intersects the boundary. That makes it easy to then compute. This was what we used initially. This is simply the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz formula. So the membrane potential at any given position on the boundary simply depends on the ionic concentrations on the two sides. And the membrane currents are made up of two parts, ion channel currents and active pumping currents. That's these terms. And again, these are details that you don't really have to worry too much about. These were what we used for ion channel currents. These are simply the Hodgkin-Huxley currents at equilibrium. And the reason for that is because this is a very slow phenomenon. Everything is coming to equilibrium very quickly. So we can just use the long time behavior of the Hodgkin-Huxley ionic currents. The pumping terms, these are just put in artificially. The idea here is simply to make sure that the intracellular concentrations get back to normal. Okay? And this term here is chosen so that when you're at equilibrium, everything comes to the proper rest state. So here's an example. Here's an example where you simulate a small system with impermeable membrane. That means this is like a real porous medium. The ions are not going to go into or out of the intracellular space. So this is a source of ions put in here, potassium ions, and then later on, so this is at t equals 0.125 milliseconds, and the injection stops at 2.5 milliseconds. And then I'm going to show you what happens at these three locations. I'm not going to do it on this picture, but yes, I am. I am going to show you. On these three, we're going to plot what the ionic concentrations look like in the next. So here they are. So these are the alpha. This is the closest one. You see the ionic concentration is going up. And then at 2.5 milliseconds, it stops. And then the solution just decays. It just diffuses away. And if you're further away, then the ionic concentrations don't go up quite as high, but everything relaxes back to what you had before. This is a more realistic case where we're assuming now that ions can cross the membranes. Now, when I say membranes, I should point out, this is not the membrane, this is extracellular space. The membrane is this boundary between these. So the blue and the white. Again, the same diffusion. This is in extracellular space. This is at 0.125 milliseconds. This is what happens after 5 milliseconds. And you can see that by the color. Notice these two scales are not the same. This is a highly exaggerated scale. You can see that the ions are just moving around in the extracellular space. But they're crossing the membranes now, so the intracellular space also is changing. And this is what you get for the intracellular space. And you can see there's a large amount of ions here being injected into this particular cell. And then later on, you see that more and more ions are going into these other regions. Now, the reason this is important is because one of the problems with these kinds of diffusion cases is that ions, they have to go someplace, and then eventually everything has to come back to normal. So what happens is that in the extracellular space, in fact, the ions sort of go back to normal, but because of this huge reservoir in the intracellular space, that takes a lot longer to come back to normal. And so we call that temporal buffering, not spatial buffering, but temporal buffering, because it's the time-dependent phenomenon that's occurring. So here are some concentration changes at three points. These three points, extracellular space, these are intracellular space. This is for potassium, this is for sodium, and this is for chloride. And let me not, those are just, you can see they're going up and then coming back down. Now this is for a larger system, basically the same piece in here, but now for with more structure around it, and you can see that it's a very similar kind of behavior. The injection time here is much longer, it's 200 milliseconds instead. The objective, of course, eventually, is to be able to put in a large amount of potassium in some area, and then try to see if you can get a spreading cortical depression wave propagating out from there. So this is the intracellular space for the same problem. Now let me tell you what spatial buffering is. Spatial buffering is the following. Remember I told you that we did not know how to change the speed of these waves because the diffusion coefficient is fixed. Now there's a phenomenon called spatial buffering which was proposed many years ago and was popularized by Gardner Medwin in the UK, and then by Nicholson, who studied it with his postdoc, Chen. Spatial buffering is the following. How can you move potassium in the extracellular space very rapidly from one place to another without just plain diffusion? And here's the way it works. If you dump in a bunch of potassium here, the effect is to depolarize this region. Right? If you depolarize this region, then you're going to get a change in membrane potential, and this membrane is membrane that's excitable. So the membrane potential itself can propagate along here by what's called electrotonic spread. That in turn will change the membrane potentials back here so that it's possible to then have potassium that's out here, that's inside, to go outside. So a potassium ion that was originally here that went in, even though it doesn't physically go over here and pop out, its effect is that. It comes in here and then an ion pops out here. So the movement of potassium from here to here can be very rapid, even though it's not the same ion. But it's moving from one location, extracellular space, to another location, extracellular space. So that was the idea, and the question is, does this spatial buffering increase the speed of spreading depression or does it decrease it? The conjecture by Gardner Medwin is that it slows it down. I think it's going to speed it up, but he thinks it's going to slow it down. So that's one thing that we want to address, is that problem, is trying to see whether this will do that or not. Now Chen and Nicholson have studied this problem from a continuum point of view. And they've also done it from a differential equations point of view. And what we're trying to do here is see if we can look at this kind of problem from a computational, from this Lattice-Boltzmann method. So let me just show you some of the results that we have for this. So here is the membrane. Here is the simple equation for voltage that Jim, in fact, wrote down. So this is the membrane potential. This is the diffusion term, if you want. This is the ionic currents. And you can solve that using finite differences. And here's the kind of things you get. So I've just simply labeled these points A, B, C, D, E, F. So these points here at the front where the concentration is higher, and these are at the back where the concentration is lower. And all I'm talking about here first is membrane potential. So this is membrane potential. You see that there's a large increase, a large depolarization at the front end. This is A, B, C. and then lower depolarizations at DEF. Okay, so this is time, this is membrane potential. Now we're going to look at the concentrations of potassium. And the idea is that we want to see potassium move from here over to there. So we'll look at the concentrations at these different locations. So again, little a, little b, little c, D, E, and F. Oops, that wasn't good. How do I do this? I think I know what the problem was here. Okay. So there's A, B, C, and D, E, and F, right? Now, so this is the time course in the extracellular space and intracellular space of potassium. And you can see at A, B, and C, these things go up and come down. These go up and come down, except for this C goes down a little bit. But in the extracellular space at D, E, and F, which are near the back of this cell, you can see what happens here. The concentration goes up first and then goes down and then recovers. Now, in a sense, this increase here is a result of the depletion of potassium from the inside. So there's an increase here, but then there's an eventual depletion. So it's not clear what this means in terms of the transport of potassium from one location to the other. So the movement of these of this potassium from the front to the back is not clear whether that's actually going to work because of this increase and then decrease. So anyway, what I wanted to do today was simply to explain a little bit about what spreading cortical depression is, tell you why the models that have been are out there right now may not explain it correctly, because we don't really understand what the mechanisms are. I wanted to show you how one can use a completely different numerical scheme, this Lattice-Boltzmann method, for solving these kind of problems. And the nice thing about this method is that you can come up with any kind of geometry and you could use this method. That's what I think is the beauty of it. The question is, do we have enough computational power to do it? This is a very small region that we're looking at. We really want to look at large areas of the brain at one time, if possible. And that would require lots and lots of storage space. So I showed you a little bit about the brain cell microenvironment, the diffusion of ions, and explain this idea of spatial buffering. And we're still unsure as to whether this is going to have a significant effect on spreading depression. So anyway, thank you very much.